You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Some interesting things here to ponder. In our third hour, by the way, I want to get into international trade. Did you know that China has just threatened to put a 20% tariff on American cars? And this isn't about China. This is about American trade policy. It's like, you know, why are we insane and the rest of the world has figured out how things work? And we used to do it right. But we'll get into that in the third hour. In the first hour, last night, let me begin at the end. I was walking out of Fox News last night. I was on Fox Business News debating a fellow about trade policy, or about big government. And as I'm walking out, I open the door and run into Karl Rove. I mean, literally ran into Karl Rove. And it was like I had this feeling like there was an evil presence. You ever had that? I'm sure I'm projecting this, you know, because I think of him, along with the other members of the Bush administration, as a man responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people, as a war criminal. You know, it's like the way that you think of Goebbels, or, you know, one of Hitler's underlings, particularly Goebbels, his propagandist. And I just, you know, I didn't say, hey, Turd Blossom, or, you know, which is, I guess, what George W. Bush used to say to him. I just walked on out. I mean, there was no, I mean, it's Fox News. What are you going to do? But anyhow, I'd been there earlier. Yeah, you know, I was on my way out because the survey came out yesterday from a Gallup, this Gallup survey, which says the 64% of Americans don't trust big government or are concerned about the threat of big government. 26% of Americans are concerned about the threat of big business. 8% of Americans are concerned about the threat of big labor. Now, on Fox, I pointed out that if you go back to 1965, almost a third of Americans were concerned about the threat of big labor, about a third of 29%, about a third of Americans were concerned about big government, 35%. And only 17% of Americans were concerned about big business. So back in the 60s, people were worried more about big labor than big business, 29 to 17%. Now it's more than reversed, 3 to 1. Now you've got 26% of Americans who are afraid of big business, 8% who are afraid of big labor, but 64% afraid of big government. And so the question is, you know, if 64% of Americans, and by the way, this was Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all, I mean, you know, obviously Republicans much higher numbers, Democrats much lower numbers, Independents kind of in between, but all of them were more, well over 50%. Yeah, I'm concerned about big government. And so Fox wanted to know, I don't know what they wanted, you know, hey, you want to come on and defend big government? So the first thing this guy says is, you know, government has increased in size 25% since Barack Obama became president. And I'm like, what? If you saw it last night, there was a moment of a pregnant pause there because I suddenly realized that I was in Fox News. It's like I'm in an alternative universe. When I was a kid, I used to read Superman comics, and there was this bizarro world where everything was the exact reverse of here. And if you went into the bizarro world, you had to say the opposite of what you meant. And people understood that. And so I was kind of taken aback. You know, since Obama came in, government has increased by 25%. Oh, really? I mean, Government has laid off almost a half million people. If government hadn't laid off all those federal and state workers, unemployment would be in the neighborhood of 7% right now. So how could government be 25% larger if it's laid off a half million workers? Well, Paul Ryan says so. So we go back and look at the quote from Paul Ryan, and it's like, well, yeah, since Obama came in, non-defense discretionary spending. Okay, the defense budget's about half the budget, right? It's $1.4 trillion. The whole budget, I think, is $3.2 trillion. I'm doing this from memory, but close enough. And then you've got non-discretionary spending, which is Medicare, Social Security, stuff like that. That's a big chunk of the budget. It's well over a third. So when you get down to the part that's non-defense and non-discretionary, it's like this tiny slice of the government. And it includes things like food stamps and Medicare and, excuse me, not Medicare, food stamps and, I don't know how unemployment insurance works in there, because I know most of it comes through the states, but the federal government's backstopping it with these extensions, so it's got to have unemployment insurance. It's basically all the programs that are available to people if they're out of work. And if you're comparing it with revenues, because government revenues have gone down ever since the Bush Great Depression began, because people don't have money, they're not, you know, they don't have incomes, they don't have jobs, so they're not paying income taxes. So and businesses are not showing profits, so they're not paying income taxes. And so and tax cheating has gone way up, and the billionaires are putting more and more money in Switzerland and et cetera. So probably, you know, a slice of a slice of a slice of federal spending that represents what happens when you go into a recession has gone up and appropriately should have. It's called the social safety net. And apparently that's what they were talking about. But that's a very different thing from this hallucinatory, you know, statement of, well, you know, government is, since Barack Obama came in, has gotten 25% bigger. No, it hasn't. So the only thing I could think of, not being a regular Fox viewer and therefore not understanding the bizarre world in which these guys live, the only thing I could think of was to say, well, let's see, you know, Bush gave us two wars and didn't put them on the budget. And so that money was hidden, other than showing up in the deficit. And Bush gave us Medicare Part D and didn't pay for that, so that wasn't on the budget. So that was hidden and just shows up on the deficit. And when President Obama was campaigning, I remember he said, I'm going to put those things on the budget so everybody can see where they are. So, of course, if you go from taking hundreds of billions of dollars that you're spending on wars and on pharmaceuticals for Medicare that is invisible on the budget and suddenly make it visible, it's going to look like you're spending more money, even though you're not spending an extra penny. And the difference is that George Bush was lying to us and Barack Obama isn't. So that's what I said. But there is a real point to liberals being afraid of government. I think the whole idea that, you know, the president is asserting that he can kill people, even American citizens, without a trial is way too much big government for me. I think the idea that the FBI under the Patriot Act can simply write a letter and they can be inside my computer, they can be inside my mail, they can listen to my phone calls without a judge ever signing off on a search warrant, as the Constitution requires, is way too much big government. I think the fact that our defense budget has tripled since 1997 is way too much big government. And I think the fact that kids can't go to college for free and we don't have national free health care is way too little big government.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I guess it's all a matter of definitions, but still, the story here, the Gallup poll, the headline, in U.S., fear of big government at near record level.
Give me one reason to steer, and I'll turn right back around. Give me one reason to steer, and I'll turn right back around.
Well, and that's what Obama did, is he turned it around. I mean, and please don't think that I'm sitting here as a partisan apologist for Barack Obama, for President Obama, because I'm very much not. I do know, however, that if John McCain had been elected president, we would be in the same situation that Herbert Hoover had this country in 1929, 1930, 1931, and 1932, is we would still be losing 700,000 jobs a month, as we were the day that Barack Obama took office. And he passed a $700 billion stimulus bill, a third of which was tax cuts, which was a waste. So it was really about a $500 billion stimulus bill, 400 and change. Nowhere near big enough, but it did stop the hemorrhaging, at least over the short term. But $700 billion over a three-year period, that's not a 25% increase in government. I'm sorry. You know, you got about a $3.2 trillion government annually. And so, you know, that would be maybe if none of it was paid back and it produced no income and no stimulation and no effect at all, and it was just totally, you know, flew away, it would maybe be a 5% increase in government or something like that, but 25%. But anyhow, I was talking with David Asman. The show was Power and Money on Fox Business Channel last night. And just notice, you make a point and, oh, wait a minute, we're not going to talk about that. That's not reality.
Pretty after close. 9/11, we got two wars that were not paid for.
Right.
So,
right.
We've got a serious problem, and that's too big a government
so things
for me.
Things change a little. But, look, the fact of the matter is that big government is something that has happened. We've had a 25% increase in the size of the federal government during the Obama administration, even more if you take it back to when Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House. This is clearly a response to that, when you look at how many people don't like big government.
The government has grown by a quarter in the last 3 years, 25%?
25% since President Obama took office.
I know that what has happened is that before President Obama took office, George Bush was spending money and not putting it on the budget. The Iraq War was not on the budget. The Afghanistan War was not on the budget. Medicare Part D was not on the budget. President Obama said, we're going to put these things on the budget.
Tommy,
so now those numbers are showing up. Before, those numbers weren't showing up, and we were being billed for them.
But, Tom,
I haven't seen an increase in government. Numbers now, whereas we were getting dishonest numbers under the Bush administration.
The stimulus was how much?
$700 billion.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, so let's change the subject. It's weird, too, because I quite clearly remember saying, I don't know where you're getting your numbers from. And that's no longer on there. I wonder. Of course, this was a pre-record, so it's probably been edited, which, you know, is right. Here's another example of this. I thought this was fascinating.
And that stimulus program took us from losing 700,000 jobs a month to 14 months of continuous private sector job growth. And most of all of that money has been paid back. Seems like a reasonably good investment to me.
Not that the stimulus is a good investment. It hasn't changed yet.
Yes.
Unemployment has continued to go up since the stimulus
unemployment just went down.
Yeah, it went down. It was supposed to never go higher than 8% because of the stimulus.
Dave, how can
that
you
was
say
the president's
we went,
own words, Tom.
How can you say that we went from losing 700,000 jobs a month to 14 months of continuous positive private sector job growth,
right,
and that's a bad thing.
64% of the people think big government is a bigger threat than big business. I think that's bad news for the president. We have to leave it at that.
You know, I don't disagree with you, David, on that.
Yeah, and actually, I don't disagree with him on that. The 64% of Americans think that big government is something to worry about. Now, I would submit to you that in that 64% of Americans who think that big government is something to worry about, you've got the Fox viewers who are worried that big government, wanting to take your, you know, to run Social Security and Medicare and decrease the profit of the Koch brothers by regulating coal plants and oil plants so that they don't cause downwind cancers and pollutions, that they're afraid of that kind of big government. And I don't frankly know what percentage of that, you know, it's the majority of Republicans. So let's say that that's probably about a third of that 64%. On the Democratic side, I'm guessing that, you know, another third of that 64% of people, and by the way, this is a point I made at the very beginning of the interview with him. I don't know if it made it on the air or not. I said, he said, you know, 64%, this is a record high. And I said, yeah, it's actually 1 point below what it was when after George Bush's first year in office, which is true, or during George Bush's first year of office. I think a lot of us were very worried about that. But in any case, the other third, the third of Democrats who think the government is too big, are looking at, you know, the Chertoff porno X-ray scanners in the airports. They're looking at drones flying over North Dakota and busting cattle rustlers. They're looking at Tony Baloney in New York City, you know, spraying pepper spray in young women's faces for no reason. They're looking at you know, police actions against Occupy movements all across the country. They're looking at a government that seems very much pay for play. All parties right across the board, because of the Supreme Court decisions, because of Citizens United and a whole series of Supreme Court decisions before that. And by the way, you can learn more about that by going to movetoamend.org right now, please. Movetoamend.org, because we have to amend the Constitution to fix this. But, you know, a lot of us are concerned the government has gotten too big, in as much as it has become a partner with corporate America, which has gotten too big because nobody's enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. Why? Because, you know, because the Supreme Court gave these corporations personhood rights and now they can buy elections. By the way, I've got a piece to share with you about that. Something just happened in Wisconsin. Federal judge on a Wisconsin law about campaign limits. This is like saying, yes, we're going to go down the Mussolini road totally. So anyhow, that was my Fox News experience last night. And then as I'm walking out of the building, as I'm opening the door, Karl Rove is coming in through it. So if I seem a little weird today, now you know why.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Actually, you know, it kind of produces nightmares. 27 minutes past the hour.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Well, happy holidays. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And $662 billion is the supplemental. The total defense budget for the United States is, you know, what, $1.3 trillion or in that neighborhood a year. So this must be like a half a year. I find it particularly interesting that most Americans don't know that the only kind of spending that the Constitution, that the founders and the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution specifically limit to a two-year period. In other words, you could pass a law saying for the next 100 years, we're going to build bridges. For the next 60 years, we're going to build schools. For the next 34 years, we're going to build hospitals. For the next 19 years, we're going to build dams. For whatever. You know, over the next 10 years, we're going to go to the moon. You can do that. But you cannot pass a bill to appropriate money for military purposes for longer than 2 years. It's right there in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Why? Because they didn't trust the military. They didn't want there to be a standing army during time of peace. And therefore, you have to, at least every 2 years, and now it's getting more and more like every 6 months, because the defense contractors are constantly wanting to shove something new in, and they bought a new congressman or woman. And so now it's like every 6 months or so, we have a new defense authorization bill. And it came out of conference committee yesterday. It is being voted on in the House today. The language is nearly identical to the Senate, so in all probability, this will be the bill that will go to the president. Carl Levin says that they have made changes in it that will not allow the indefinite detention by the military or the arrest by the military on U.S. soil of U.S. citizens. Dianne Feinstein put that legislation into, or that amendment into, the Senate bill. There are others who are not quite so, who are skeptical of it, let's say. Over at the Daily Paul, this is a libertarian website, of course, a Ron Paul website, they're suggesting, we have bad news to report. Call your representative today and tell them to oppose not the National Defense Authorization Act in its total, but Sections 1021 and Sections 1022. My guess is this will be passed and the president will sign it because everybody's saying, well, we've got it cleaned up. The president had threatened to veto it. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what comes out of this. Frankly, I'm concerned, and this is, you know, the what I was saying on Fox News yesterday. I think the government is too much power, period, when it comes to things like personal liberties and the ability to pursue whoever it decides is a bad guy on U.S. territory. I think that there should be the third branch of government, the judiciary, involved in that process, balancing the power of the first branch, balancing the power of the second branch of government, the executive. Carlana in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carlana, you wanted to talk about the Defense Authorization Act. What's up?
Right. I'm really disgusted with a progressive reaction to this because it's like Hurricane Katrina is on its way and everybody's acting like, oh, it's not going to be too
Hurricane
bad.
Hurricane Katrina hit in 2001. It was called the Patriot Act.
I agree with that. But what the thing about this particular act is that fiddling with it a little bit is not good enough. It's number one, it's a violation of the Constitution, and the senators and the Congress people took an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And number two, it violates a number of foreign treaties that have been signed over the years. So we're going to be basically what these provisions do, which are just referred to as the detainee provisions,
right,
along with some other things involving
yeah,
the
this
drug
is Section
war.
1021 and Section 1022.
Well, it's Section 1031 to 1037. Anyway, the point being, both of those sections should be deleted from the act, totally deleted from the act.
I agree.
And anybody who's agreeing with any fiddling around is agreeing to a violation of the Constitution. And it, in effect, what it does, it declares war on every person in the world who has an anti-American attitude, and any president in the future can decide that that person who's got anti-American opinions may be determined to be an enemy of our country, and they can do with them what they will.
Carlana,
so
I would say that the legislation doesn't say that, but it moves us in that direction.
It certainly does, and the point is...
No, it says specifically you have to declare yourself to be a member of Al-Qaeda to fall into those provisions.
Well, I don't understand why we're not... urging everybody to call right this minute. The most valuable use of time would be your senators, because obviously the House will pass it. But
no, the Senate's already passed it.
Calling their senators.
No, the Senate has already passed it. The House is passing language identical to the Senate's, which means that it came out of conference as the Senate language. So it's already too late to call the Senate. Now you got to call the House and say, don't vote for this or amend this before you vote for it. And you have to call the White House and tell the president, you know, veto this thing. Take these segments out of this thing that are plainly and clearly unconstitutional. And more importantly, that are un-American. They're just un-American. Ray in Dartmouth, Mass. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I was watching the Twitter feed, and Fox Nation tweeted out something that really caught my eye and really made me a little anxious. They're talking about Times Magazine. Person of the year being the protesters.
Right.
And Fox Nation actually said or tweeted, Time Magazine embraces the domestic terrorist. So essentially what they're saying is Occupy Wall Street here in the United States and in Egypt and in Russia are domestic terrorists.
Right. And, well, you would expect that from Fox. I mean, you know, Fox is a business deal for Rupert Murdoch, and it's interesting. I was having this conversation yesterday with some folks who were trying to figure out, actually with a couple of Democratic strategists who were off the air, who were trying to figure out why would Fox not support Mitt Romney? You know, the entire Republican establishment is supporting Mitt Romney, and why is Fox giving Newt Gingrich all this time? And I'm saying, because if you look at it, forget about the politics of it for a minute. Forget about what's best for the nation for a minute. And think of it like you're a billionaire named Rupert Murdoch, who is a naturalized U.S. citizen, but you were born in Australia, your wife was born in China, you have very little loyalty to this country, you're willing to break the laws of other countries. I mean, look at what happened in the U.K. with the phone hacking scandal and things in order to make more money. And so... Your goal is to make money. Murdoch's goal is to make money. Murdoch's not an ideologue. Roger Ailes, who works for him, is an ideologue. But, you know, ultimately, it's Rupert Murdoch's say. And so from Murdoch's point of view, if you get Newt Gingrich in there as the candidate or some other wackadoodle who has no chance at all of winning against President Obama, it's actually going to help the ratings of Fox News for Obama to get another term. Because, you know, hey, that black guy's still in the White House. Let's freak out some more people. Let's be more scared. You know, all that kind of stuff. It lets them just crank up the fear machine that much more. And whereas, on the other hand, if you get a rational Republican, if you got Mitt Romney in the White House, who's actually a semi-rational Republican, I mean, you know, strip away the rhetoric that he's having to use right now to get the Republican base to go along with him, he will go back to the middle. And I don't think he's an Eisenhower Republican, but he's close to being a Nixon Republican. You know, he's a rational Republican. His father was the governor of Michigan when I was a little kid growing up, and he was actually a very decent Republican. You know, George Romney, and you know, the guy was the governor of one of the most liberal states in the country, elected him governor, and he passed passed Romneycare, he passed, you know, Obamacare, he passed what was originally Nixon's health care plan that Teddy Kennedy blew up in 72. So,
yeah,
you know, from Rupert Murdoch's point of view, if Mitt Romney gets elected, all of a sudden you've got a rational Republican pushing back on the crazed Republican talking points that Fox News is putting out. That's bad for business.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The exact quote that they actually tweeted out was, "Time honors domestic terrorists."
Right.
Unbelievable.
Right. Whenever you say, thank you very much for the call, whenever you say Fox, think of it in terms of a business deal by a billionaire who doesn't care about the future of the nation, what's good for the nation, but cares about how he can make more money. How can he get more ratings for his television network, which is the number one cable television network that deals with news. Now, most people are actually watching dramas. They're over watching USA Today or not USA, what USA Network or whatever it is. You know, Psych, you know, those kinds of programs. But anyhow, Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom, real quick, I just want to say that it looks like Obama is reading from your playbook, but the Republicans, I think, have effectively gotten a foothold in criticizing him because he hasn't gone far enough. And so they point to his liberal policies and they say, oh, look, they're failures. So I think that he's giving liberals kind of a bad name. Hopefully he's changing his course a little bit. And then finally, Newt Gingrich, his ascendancy reminds me of them. It seems like they're running Frank Luntz for president.
Yeah. I had a fellow on the TV show last night I was talking with, and he said, you know, the problem with Newt is that Newt thinks he's a genius, and he's not. He's just a fairly smart repackager. And it's like Stephen Colbert the other day pointed out that all four of Newt's space weapons that are like big deal weapons, you know, his innovative, bold space proposals, all four of them are plot devices from James Bond movies. And, you know, but done by the bad guys from the moon, you know, the mirrors from the moon and the pulse, the electromagnetic pulse, all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think Newt's more of a cartoon character.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But he's a cartoon character who could give the president a run for his money. Let's keep in mind, we thought Ronald Reagan was a cartoon character, too. And look at the damage he did. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. CallCongress.org has the phone number. There's some toll-free numbers. We have to update them. If you have any updated toll-free numbers for Congress, various organizations put them out, particularly right-wing organizations put them out. It's really nice to put up their numbers because they got a lot of money to pay for them. But in any case, if you can come across any toll-free numbers for Congress, let us know, because I think most of the ones that are on our site have expired or been pulled, but the basic number for calling Congress is there, as well as the White House comment line. And, of course, our number, 866-786-THO, or excuse me, 866-987-THOM. And if you want to call in and argue with me, we have a special line just for conservatives. And you do go to the front of the line. It's 866-745-CONS. You'll find all those over at TomHartman.com. But call the House today, call your member of the House of Representatives and say, hey, either amend or vote down the Defense Authorization Act, and call the White House and say, veto the damn thing. Make them do it over. Here's the other interesting thing. I got two quick interesting things to share with you, and then I'm going to pick up your calls. All the lines are full right now, but we just have a few seconds. But number one, Mitt Romney. This I find this hysterical. This quote, okay? This is over Daily Kos. This quote. He has been an extraordinarily unreliable leader in the conservative world, not 16 or 17 years ago, but the last 2 to 3 years. And even during the campaign, the number of times he's moved from one spot to another has been remarkable. I think he showed a level of unreliability as a conservative leader today. Now, who said that? Mitt Romney, accusing Newt Gingrich of flip-flopping. Yep. And the other thing is, you know, the Republicans passed through the House this extension of the payroll tax cut on working people in America so that they could say, hey, we voted for a tax cut on average working people here in the House of Representatives, us Republicans. And Reid originally said this is dead on arrival. And so all over Fox News and every place else, all the conservative bloggers, the Democrats won't allow there to be a vote on whether or not there should be a payroll tax cut for working Americans. So Harry Reid calls their bluff. He says, okay, cool, let's have a vote in the Senate. Now included in this bill, you know, there's some pretty weird stuff. Like requiring people who get unemployment to take drug tests. And all of a sudden, Mitch McConnell doesn't want Republicans in the Senate to have to vote for it. So he says, no, pull the vote. Republicans just shot themselves in the foot. I find it hysterical. Jenny in Portland. Hey, Jenny, what's up?
Hi, I'm on the road, but I want to say that the National Defense Act that we're discussing right now, it is really the final nail in the setup of the corporate fascist state. Because once they get the people looking out against each other, they have succeeded. And I think this is the most important issue of the day.
I think it is absolutely one of the most important issues. I think that final nail has, you know, I think we're quite a ways away from that. But I think that the Patriot Act took us from 30 on the dial to 70 on the dial. And this will take us from 70 to 75 or some variation thereof. But anyway. Joseph in Los Angeles. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I kind of feel that this small government versus big government argument is bogus. Case in point,
agreed.
I'm a former employee of a Japanese manufacturer, one of the top three here in the United States. And on paper, this company's staffing looks very lean, but it doesn't take into account or consideration all of the private contractors this company hires throughout the country, and we're talking about around, you know, almost half.
Right.
So you could, it's the same argument with government, big government versus small government argument. You reduce the government workforce, say, by 100, but they're going to have to hire 100 people from the private sector and most likely at inflated salaries.
Yeah, well, there is that. But the reality is that if you look at the red states, the Republican states, there's 24 red states where the governors, Republican governors have, and Republican congresses have cut taxes, cut spending, and laid off people. And then there's 25 blue states where they have increased spending, increased taxes, and hired people, and there's one state that's been basically neutral. And when you look at those, what you see is that those red states have actually seen a drop in their economic activity and an increase in unemployment. And the blue states, where they've spent more money, they've raised taxes and spent more money, there has been a drop in unemployment. More people have had jobs, and they've seen an increase in economic activity. So we have the Petri dish. And at the federal level, you know, the Obama administration, there's been this hiring freeze, and there's also been a pay freeze for a couple of years. And you know, I just think that that's crazy. I think that that's not how you stimulate the economy. Crazy is too strong a word. You know, it's not the best policy to do, but it is politically popular right now. Oh, the government's too big. We got to do something about it. Frankly, one of the people in the chat room said this best. And let me see if I can find it. Really, here it is, right here. It's Benedict. He says, measuring how many people are afraid of big government is stupid because big government has no definition. All that's being measured is how well the right wing has propagandized the words big government. And I think that that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, government spending as a percentage of GDP in the United States is around 23% right now. Before the recession, it was 19%. In other words, the rest of the economy was bigger and government was smaller because we weren't having to cover the cost of people who are out of work. So we average around 20%, 20-something. The cost of government, you know, government as a percentage of GDP in most other developed countries in the world, like Canada or France or Germany, is well over 50%. And so, for that, what people get is free college, free health care, and, a rational-sized military. So, you know, it's not the question. I don't think the question is big government, bad government, small government, you know, all that. Bigger, small government. I think it's, do you have the government that you want? Do you have the government that your country needs? And we're a ways from that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in our first hour, just a quick reminder, the House voting today on the defense authorization bill. You can let them know what you think. CallCongress.org has the phone numbers. And let the White House know your thoughts on that. This is an issue that has ignited indignation and concern on both the right and the left. And I think they need to hear from all of us. Ron Ross is on the line with us. He's an author, an economist, the author of The Unbeatable Market, writes over at the Spectator, spectator.org, the American Spectator. His most recent piece, Inequality in Perspective. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. I'm a little baffled by this article where you say liberal thinking is all we need to know about life's fundamental unfairness. The heart and soul of liberalism is economic egalitarianism, making this a policy objective. Liberals never seem to take the effort to analyze or diagnose the sources of what they see as problems. Their concern rarely penetrates the surface. Liberals see income leveling as a cash cow. Do you really believe that stuff?
Well, yes, I do. I only write what I believe.
Are you familiar with the research that Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett have done over the last 30 years in the UK at the Equality Trust? They've written two books about it, Why Equality Matters and the Spirit Level. Their website's equalitytrust.org.uk.
No, I haven't read those. I've read several columns like the one I referred to in the article, in Mother Jones and places like that.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about Mother Jones. I'm talking about real economists and real epidemiologists. Their numbers suggest that if, and they're looking at the OECD countries, and they graph out on a horizontal axis income inequality, and on a vertical axis a variety of indices, okay? Then
right.
Life expectancy, math and literacy, infant mortality, homicides, imprisonment, teenage births, trust, obesity, mental illness, drug and alcohol addiction, social mobility, sexually transmitted diseases. And what they find, and at the bottom of income inequality, of course, are Japan, Sweden, Norway, Finland, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Switzerland, Germany, Austria, and Spain. And then at the top of income inequality is the U.S., and just slightly behind that, Portugal, the U.K., and New Zealand. And what they find is that if, just looking at income inequality, if our country, if the United States, was to reach income inequality levels that are seen by most of the European countries, like for example, Germany, Denmark, Belgium, Finland, Norway, Sweden, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Spain, that our murder rate would halve. Our mental illness would be reduced by two-thirds. Our obesity rate would halve. Our imprisonment rate would reduce by 80%. Our teen births would reduce by 80%. And our level of trust among people between each other and within society, and this is an interesting thing that I was on Fox yesterday about, 65% of Americans, 64% of Americans now say they don't trust big government. Our level of trust would increase by 85%. So, you know, looking at the just core scientific evidence that unequal societies do poorly and more equal societies do better on these basic standard of life indicators, why would you be in favor of policies that make societies more unequal or against policies that make societies more equal, pretty much regardless of what they are, in the abstract?
Well, to begin with, I don't think that more equality would be the panacea that you're talking about.
I'm not calling it a panacea. I'm calling it reducing murder rates by half is not reducing them by 100%. That's not a panacea.
Like, we'd have peace on earth, goodwill to men if we only had equality, more equality. And I'm not against equality, One of the main lessons of economics, maybe the main lesson of economics, is that life consists of trade-offs. And that there is a price to pay if you just go towards equality without really having a plan or looking at what the cost would be.
Well, we had a much more equal society in the United States during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s when the top income tax rate was between 74% and 91%. When corporations were paying 35% of the total federal budget, now they're paying 8% or 9%. We had a much more equal society. And we have actually a petri dish here in the United States. And this is, again, research done. You can find it at equalitytrust.org.uk. I encourage you to check it out. This was done in the United States, state by state. And they're looking at just one index, for example, and I can give you, you know, any of these that I gave you the list of before, but let's just look at education, for example. The lowest income inequality in the United States is Alaska. Okay? Alaska has the fewest number of very rich people and the fewest number of very poor people and the highest number of people in the middle in the United States. They also have the lowest number of people dropping out of high school. The highest income inequality in the United States is Mississippi. Mississippi has more people who are super rich and more people who are super poor and a smaller middle class than any other state in the United States. And Mississippi also has, while Alaska's high school dropout rate is 11%, Mississippi's high school dropout rate is 28%. And I can give you all the states in between, but when you put them on a scatter graph, you can draw a line right through them. Alaska is the most equal state in the United States, followed by Utah at 12%, very low income inequality and only 12% high school dropout. On the other end, below Mississippi is Louisiana with 25% high school dropout, another very unequal state. The most unequal states are Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Kentucky, West Virginia, Texas, California, Tennessee, Arkansas, South Carolina, Rhode Island, Georgia, Florida, and they all have high school dropout rates above 20%. The most equal states in the union, where you have the fewest very rich people and the fewest very poor people and the largest middle class, are Alaska, Utah, New Hampshire, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Nebraska, Vermont, Wyoming, Montana, Washington State, Maine, Idaho, Delaware, and Indiana, and they all have high school dropout rates below 15%. So just looking at a simple index like that, which is the best predictor of the future of our nation, wouldn't you say inequality is destroying the future of our country?
Well, I'm not going to argue that, because, and I'm not going to argue any of your data there. I think you're probably all that's probably correct. But so how do you do that? How do you make Mississippi more like Alaska, for example?
Well, I would do it by going back to the policies that we had, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and raising taxes on the top. And having corporations pay their fair share.
Raise the top rate to?
Anything over 50%. History shows that when the top rate is over 50%, you don't have bubble economies, and when it's below 50%, you end up with bubble economies. So I think going back, I'd roll back the Reagan tax cuts. I'd take it back to 74%.
Well,
and then use that money to build schools in Mississippi.
When the rates were at 70% and 90%, hardly anybody paid that. That there were there were so many loopholes and so many tax shelters that those rates were basically fictitious, and you know, the president's committee to on the debt reduction advocated a flat rate of 23%.
But in 1960, the top 1% paid 42% of their average income in taxes. And right now, they pay the top 1% pay 17.6% of their average income in taxes. So I'd say tax rates do matter.
Okay. And so you think that...
And I would cut that. But, Ron, I'm sorry. We're out of time. And I didn't mean to nail you with the last word here. Please come back, and I'll give you the last word next time. Ron Ross, hang on just a second.
This
Ron.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Ron Ross, Spectator.org. You can read his work. Ron, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States. I would say We the People of Planet Earth. We're all in this thing together. You know, we really are. And if the atmosphere goes down, if the climate goes down, if politics goes down, whatever it may be, we're all in this together, and we have to acknowledge that. Frank in Orange County. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for listening to KTLK. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to, I heard he had somebody on earlier, just a few minutes ago, arguing, you were telling him about the progressive taxes we had back in the 40s to the 80s.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to, say that I really agree with you on that. Things were a lot equaler back then because I think because of the tax rates and, it prevents people from doing what they're doing now, which is, they're getting all this money, running schemes, bubble economies. But if you have a higher tax rate, then it prevents people. It's not
right.
An incentive.
With a higher tax rate, that extra incremental money is dearer, right? It's more valuable to you because you got less of the initial. Whereas with a very low tax rate, it's hot money. It's like free money. Because if you're already a millionaire and you're getting more millions, it's like, what are you going to do with that? You're not worried about whether you can eat. You're not worried whether you have a house to live in or a car to drive around or whatever. So it's like, oh, boy, I've got some extra money. Let's gamble with this. And that instinct for gambling comes in, not for everybody, but for enough people that they can totally screw an economy. And that's what happens when the top tax rate goes below 50%. And you can absolutely prove that by looking just at the history of the 20th century in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And they don't put that money back into the corporations because they don't have an incentive.
No, they don't. Absolutely right, because there is no incentive. So that needs to change. Don't just roll back the Clinton tax cuts. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Exactly.
I mean, don't just roll back the Bush tax cuts, and go back to Clinton rates, but roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and let's go back to the Jerry Ford rates, to the Richard Nixon rates, to the Dwight Eisenhower rates would be fine with me. I mean, these are all Republican presidents. They all supported top tax rates on the top 1%. And as I said, in 1960, the top 1% was paying 42% of their income in taxes, the top 1%. And today, the average income tax rate paid by the top 1% is 17.6%. That should be like all the numbers you need. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Jeff in Seattle. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I had an issue with you meeting Karl Rove last night on your meeting and how disgusted you were by that.
Well, let me rephrase that, because I made a comment about his being Goebbels. And afterwards, Jacob came into the studio. I think it was Paul came into the studio and said something about it. And I said, really, that was an exaggeration, because and it's a cheap one, because really what's surprising to me is the banality of evil. Here's a guy who arguably is responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people, Karl Rove.
OK, would those people have been killed if Saddam was still in power? Yes.
Doesn't matter. That's not the point. He's the guy.
Comparing Karl Rove to Goebbels.
It's not the. That's not the point. Now, if you're calling to defend Karl Rove,
I'm not. I just you realize that you made a mistake, and I'm glad because the comparison.
But you haven't let me say what my mistake was. My mistake was that I'm guessing that if you met Goebbels, under non-combative circumstances, you would think he was a nice guy. People thought Adolf Hitler was a nice guy. He liked dogs. He was a vegetarian. I mean, the evil, it can be incredibly banal, if that's the correct pronunciation of the word.
So are you saying that Karl Rove is evil?
I am saying that if evil is people pursuing policies that lead to the death of other people, yes, Karl Rove is evil.
on a comparison with Joseph Goebbels?
No, I don't think he's anywhere near as bad as Goebbels. Goebbels was responsible for killing 6 million people. Karl Rove killed maybe 20, 30, 40, 50, maybe 100,000 people. Or was responsible for policies that led to the death of those people. Neither one of them took a gun and put it up to somebody's head. But both of them were responsible for policies that led to that happening to a lot of people.
All right. Well, I just wanted to call you on that because I found it offensive.
Yeah.
And
well, thank you.
I don't think there's any comparison at all.
Yeah. I get it that you don't think there's any comparison at all. But and let me say, you know, I broke my own rule, which is, you know, he who mentions the Nazis first loses. And because it diminishes the significance of the Holocaust, and shouldn't have done that. And Jeff, thank you for at least calling me on that. I get that. Shlomo in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Shlomo, what's up?
Hey, I got a couple quick points here. First and foremost, as far as the size of government, as far as I remember, George Bush created Homeland Security, which was a whole new enforcement division, which was handled by the FBI.
Yeah.
So,
which used to be, yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it used to be handled by the FBI and a couple of other agencies. You know, what was the Border Service called? The Border Service? You know, the Department of INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service. Yeah. But
exactly.
And the Border.
So, I mean, that's a whole new form of government. Not only did they give them more power, but it's also just more people. So, government did get bigger under Bush.
Yeah.
That was not really what I was calling about. It was more on the effective tax rate versus the actual tax rate. So, if you raise the tax rate on the rich, aren't they going to be spending more to lower their effective tax rate? So, they'll buy more equipment and they'll make greater charitable donations and trying to get more tax write-offs?
Yes.
So effectively,
and
won't that be a stimulus by raising the rates?
Yes. And history shows that it is. The three decades, the three 10-year periods, when GDP averaged above 3.2% for an entire decade in the history of the United States, and that's a high, that's a very high point, 3.2% for a full 10 years, were the decade of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. And those were the times when the top tax rate was 91% in the 50s. Well, it was 91% right up until 64, and then it got dropped down to 74%, and it stayed there until the end of the Reagan dropped it in 86, so down to 28%. So he dropped it 50% in 81, and that produced an 11% unemployment rate. I mean, he just crashed the economy when he first dropped the tax rate on rich people. And so he raised taxes hysterically in 82 and 83 on working people to make that money back up. But yeah, you're right. And people say, you know, okay, I've already made my $1 million. I'll only take 30 times what my workers make. And that's what it was during that period of time. And leave the rest of the money in the
business.
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Mr. Potter is the ideal GOP candidate? Doug has a very strange idea he wants to share with us. Stick around.
But baby, it's cold outside. But baby, it's cold outside. Been hoping that you drop in. I'll hold your hands, they're just like ice.
Happy holidays! Merry Christmas, happy Hanukkah, happy Kwanzaa, whatever it may be for you. Happy shopping frenzy, happy non-shopping frenzy. Oh, it's a crazy alert! A penguin love triangle. A nest shared by Canada's favorite same-sex penguin couple, Buddy and Pedro, just got more crowded after zoo officials broke up the penguin duo, putting an end to what many were calling the broke-back iceberg affair that lasted for a year. Buddy has officially moved on and mated with a female penguin. The zoo's curator deemed the breakup of Toronto's so-called gay penguins necessary since the penguins are endangered species and need to mate with two females. Particular one was needed to mate with two females. Something tells me Rick Santorum was pulling the strings here. So far, unlike Buddy, Pedro has yet to find a female mate of his own, but officials say it's not for lack of trying. Michelle Bachmann's husband has allegedly reached out to offer Pedro his therapeutic services. Think it would work? I don't know. It's all pretty bizarre. Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how's it going?
What's
my
up?
Big question is, do you believe anything this John Corzine guy is saying in front about not knowing where any of this money goes? Because, you know, as anybody that's a commodity investor or a farmer in the markets right now, I have absolutely no confidence in where you know, my money's going to be if I take out a futures contract because of what he's done.
Yeah. If somebody who has a history of a reasonable level of ethical conduct like John Corzine, or has, you know, just fooled a lot of people for a lot of years, is running a company in which the people who got burned were people who were simply buying, as you point out, commodity positions. They were buying futures. And they didn't think that their money was being put into gamble. They were simply buying positions, and their money just vanished. If that can happen, pretty much anything can happen in this system. You know, whether or not I trust John Corzine, I don't have a clue. I don't know the guy. I've never met the guy. He's never represented me in Congress. I know nothing about him other than that he was a Democratic politician, which doesn't necessarily make him a good guy. So, you know, but I agree with you that the system is badly screwed. And what I find astounding is the Republicans are saying, no, there's no way that we can have Rob Cordray running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which might protect you and your commodity trades. I'm not sure what its total purview is, but it certainly would protect people with regard to credit cards and mortgages and other things. Oh, we can't have that. Why would the Republicans say we can't have that? Well, because the banks will regulate themselves, you know, and the brokerages, they'll regulate themselves. These guys know what they're doing. They'll take care of things. Don't worry. Everything's happy. Just go back to sleep. Yeah, right. Dave in Lake Orion, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, here, just for the benefit of the Karl Rove apologist, you know, I knew a guy that actually had dinner or lunch with Karl Rove and said to me, "What? You know, he's really a nice guy." But what people need to know is, here's a person that, from the time he was in college, knew what he wanted to be, and that was a political trickster, a person that would do political tricks for the benefit of the GOP, and that's obviously what he accomplished. He became the top trickster for the GOP. He's
still is
influenced elections for 35 years, and you know, he's not a nice person. I mean, he is who he is. He is
well, as I said, I had no conversation with him. I was trying to go out the door at the same time he was trying to go in the door. And, you know, we managed to avoid colliding with each other in a way that was painful. And the thing that struck me the most, my visceral responses were after the fact, as I was thinking about, oh, my God, that was Karl Rove. The thing that struck me the most was, you know, who's this relatively nice-looking, very well-dressed, pudgy little man? And, you know, I mean, it was just this, you know, he was wearing, you know, what looked like a nice jacket and maybe a cashmere scarf or something. I don't remember the details, but, you know, every hair was in place. And it just, you know, who is this, you know, pudgy little guy who you know, looks like, you know, he's a reasonable person. And, and that's why I said, you know, it's what astounds me is the banality of evil. But Dave, you're absolutely right. This has been his life's ambition, and he's accomplished it, and he's continuing to perpetrate it. And now he's got millions and millions of dollars that he can spend through the courtesy of the Supreme Court with his GPS or whatever it is, that he's already running lies, literally ads that lie about Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts. It's incredible. Doug in Los Angeles. Hey, Doug, what's up? You got Mr. Potter. What's this Mr. Potter thing?
Well, you remember when candidates used to try to appear like good people? Republicans are all trying to sound like they're trying to out-heartless each other. You know, repeal health care.
On the Republican side, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, on the Republican side. End disaster aid, Ron Paul.
Yeah.
Perry wants to end gay rights, bring back child labor. Now, all these statements are pretty callous. You know, good try. But if the Republicans really want great, snide, utterly heartless sound bites, their ideal candidate is Mr. Potter, the villain of It's a Wonderful Life. You know, like, should we pay off the deficit by raising taxes on billionaires? Old man Potter says, what does that get us? A discontented, lazy rabble instead of a thrifty working class.
Yeah. You know, it's been so many years since I saw It's a Wonderful Life that I was mixing up Mr. Potter with Jefferson Smith, with Jimmy Stewart's character.
Oh, no. This is
yeah,
the bad
Mr.
guy.
Potter was the bad guy. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean,
you're
should right. poor children get food stamps? Potter says, not my children, not with my money.
You do that very well. I mean, it's almost like South Park these days.
Potter understands why people say we're the 99%.
Yeah.
The envious ones say that, George, the suckers.
Yeah, there you go.
You got a message for seniors on Medicare? You're worth more dead than alive.
You know, Doug, I think that the Republicans are channeling Mr. Potter, and thank you for sharing your marvelous impersonations with us. Very well done. Andy in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Got a couple of things. You and I are about the same age, and do you remember when you were growing up?
Andy, if you're talking on a speakerphone, could you pick it up, please? You know, I understand the speakerphone because the, you know, you've been on hold for a while and all that, but it just sounds awful.
Okay.
Great.
A couple things. The first thing is, when you and I grew up about the same age, your dad was a machinist. My dad was a locomotive engineer.
Mm-hmm. Well, my dad was both a machinist and a bookkeeper. He did the bookkeeping for that tool and die shop as well. And he knew how to run most every machine in the place.
Okay. What I'm getting to is in your neighborhood, I'm sure not only where you live, but there was also attorneys and doctors and things.
Not in my neighborhood.
In your neighborhood as well.
No, really? we lived in a neighborhood that was lower middle class. I mean, Dad bought the house for $13,000 in 1965, and it was, you know, three bedroom, one bathroom, and there were six of us. And I'd say the average income in that neighborhood in today's dollars was probably $30,000-$35,000 in today's dollars. You know, back then it was far less than that. So
right, dad did the same thing.
There were no lawyers or doctors in my neighborhood that I knew of. There, you know, or anything close to it. Everybody worked at Oldsmobile. Louise's neighborhood. My wife Louise, we started dating when we were teenagers. Her dad was the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. She lived in a fancy neighborhood, fancy by my definitions. But it was a middle-class neighborhood in East Lansing, just off the campus of MSU, where all the people around her were doctors, lawyers, professors, people like that. But in any case, your point.
Well, my point is, in our neighborhood, my dad bought a house for about $13,000. It was a middle-income neighborhood, except that we had doctors and lawyers in our neighborhood. And the reason we did was because they were paying the same kind of taxes that back in the time of the 60s. That we all kind of lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, okay. And, well, Tom Stedman, the kid who lived behind me when I was 6 years old, his dad was a dentist. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And it's changed now. Everybody now, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you live in a gated community or you live away from the normal middle class, and you lose that touch with everyday people.
Yeah, yeah. Good
and
point.
We didn't have that problem. The second thing, real quick, is people are tired of lying. And that's what it all boils down to, whether it's the government or big business, corporations, whatever. That's why I would prefer that you call Fox GOP News TV as call it a Fox disinformation channel, because what they're doing is they're telling half-truths, lies, to get people to believe what they want them to believe.
Yeah, it's, you know, at a certain level, that sounds so ad hominem that people cease to take it seriously. But I refer to them as GOP TV, which was the original name that Roger Ailes came up with in 72 when he proposed it to Richard Nixon, when he worked in the Nixon White House, and as Fox so-called news, which I think says it without, you know, without the edge that would cause people to not take it seriously. But your point is well made, Andy, and particularly your point on how doctors, you know, again, I remember as a little kid, doctors making house calls. I remember, you know, the first business that Louise and I started of any substance that we ended up having 18 employees, we were paying $35 per month per person for Blue Cross Blue Shield for health insurance for them. And this was back in the 70s, but, you know, insurance was not expensive because every state in the union, including Michigan, where we were, had a law that said that if you're going to offer health insurance, you have to be a nonprofit corporation. There were not for-profit companies selling health insurance. And there were no for-profit hospitals in the state of Michigan, to the best of my knowledge, at that time. You had Ingham Medical, which was run by Ingham County, which is where Lansing was. You had St. Luke's, which was, I think, run by the Catholic Church, I'm assuming. There was, I think maybe one other hospital. Sparrow Hospital was a nonprofit corporation. And that was it. And now I believe that they're all run by for-profit corporations, and you know, it's like everything has changed. Andy, excellent point. Very well said. Daycare, by the way, was affordable. In fact, when Louise and I owned a travel agency in Atlanta, most of the people who worked there were women, young women who had children. So we literally built a child care center in our travel agency to provide that to people. I mean, that's what people used to do. That was in the 80s.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of your calls. We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com as well.
Welcome
back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st Century by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And speaking of Ellen Ratner in the studio.
Phone works a little better today. Okay.
Indeed.
The Senate balanced budget votes just happened today. The Udall balanced budget amendment was rejected, 79-21. And the Orrin Hatch, that's the Republican one, was rejected 47-53. So there was quite a bit of Democratic crossover or whatever on the Udall vote.
Interesting.
But everybody can go home and say, I voted for the balanced budget amendment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like anybody cares.
The defense authorization bill conference report will be coming up today. They're expected to go home early, 5:30 or 6, of course. The other issue is next week the government turns into a pumpkin.
Right. Friday is when funding runs out. But is the defense authorization going to be voted on at the end of the day today, or is it simply coming up?
No. It should be voted on today.
By the end of the day?
Yes, by the end of the day.
Okay, so let your member of the House. This is in the House of Representatives. Let your member of Congress know, your House of Representative, your congressman or woman know your concerns. I have some very specific concerns about this piece of legislation and civil liberties and the world being a battlefield.
Yeah, well, exactly. And speaking, I mean, I just guess I'm going to move to the world being a battlefield because today the president is down at Fort Bragg. I have not gotten yet a transcript of what he talked about. But Jay Carney was pressed this morning, I would say 3 or 4 times, don't if my count isn't exactly, but at least 3 times, maybe 4, by the press on Air Force One when he gaggled. In other words, that's not a formal press thing. He was asked whether this was a worthwhile war, whether the Iraq war was a sensible war, whether we should have done it. He said, history will judge whether the war was worth it. The president's position has not changed, which is to he did not support getting into this war. But he committed as a candidate and reiterated to ending this war responsibly and to making sure that he took, as commander-in-chief, the steps he took were the right ones. He was also asked again about it. He said, well, is it a fair question? And he said, well, I'm not saying it's not a fair question, but we decided to make a decision when the president had an oath of office, and it's fair. And then he also talked about Afghanistan.
Now, if I could just wrap this, what he's trying to avoid, in my opinion, do a reality check on me with this, is that John Kerry quote from when he was in his 20s, and he sat before the United States Senate, I believe it was, and said, who wants to be the last man to die for a mistake?
And that came back to haunt
Kerry. It came back to haunt Kerry, but Obama and Carney and all of them, who were opposed to the Iraq war from the get-go, who thought it was a mistake, if they admit, if they say out loud, you know, this was a mistake, they're basically saying 5,000 people died in vain, and you just can't say that. Everybody may know it, but you can't say it out loud. I mean, that as a political reality.
Right.
So that's what I think is
the other thing that happened is Speaker Boehner this morning said a few things to the press. He said that one of the things he started to laugh when he was asked whether he could name any small businesses that were affected by a surtax on millionaires and billionaires. And he couldn't name any small businesses, but he did say it was hurting.
Who said this?
Speaker Boehner.
Boehner.
Can you name one? Yeah, exactly.
Just name one.
Right. Couldn't do it.
Coke Industries? He couldn't pull that one
small
out?
Small business.
Oh, well, but they actually pay their taxes as a small business.
Oh, they do?
Even though it's a $50 billion enterprise.
Wow, how was I supposed to know about that?
Yeah.
He was also, Boehner was also asked about Gingrich today. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, he's had some great ideas and some other ideas. And then he denied that he had anything to do with trying to get Gingrich out of the speakership.
Really? I thought he was... He played the role that Eric Cantor is playing right now of the guy with the shit in the
back. That's what everybody else in this town thought.
Yeah.
But guess what? He didn't do it.
Now he's all sweetness and light.
He is all sweetness and light.
Is it increasingly looking like Newt Gingrich might be the Republican nominee?
Oh, my God. And, you know, it's interesting. The White House and everybody has expected to run against Romney. So
right.
What happens if they run against Newt Gingrich?
Well, it's not like they have to dig real deep to get opposition research.
It's pretty easy.
It's on Wikipedia.
It is pretty easy. It's pretty easy. Jeff just handed me this story as I was walking in here, and it's interesting. We have video of it. Apparently, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans. It's headed up by a Democrat. And they are saying, All four other commissioners are saying that this guy bullies staff members. He's a Democrat who heads it up. Mm-hmm. And it came up today at a hearing. And they've written to the White House. I've been covering Washington since 1992. I have never seen a commission come out so publicly against somebody who's running their commission. I've never seen it happen.
Oh, that's interesting. So, in other words, one of Obama's nominees was basically a jerk.
I guess so.
And
both the Democrats and the Republicans, he's reunited the two sides.
They all agree he's a jerk.
They all agree he's a jerk.
And this is the NRC?
Yes.
Is he going to resign?
Well, the way he said it, well, I was here, you know, I got into a little bit of a heated argument with somebody over the Japan crisis and the
Fukushima.
Tsunami. Yeah. But that's all he would say.
Huh.
Honestly, the years I've been covering Washington, never seen that happen.
Well, typically, jerks don't back down from being jerks.
Yeah.
Okay, what else is going on?
I guess so. Syria, it's interesting today. There's fighting that is going back in Syria. Army defectors have actually ambushed government soldiers. So this is turning out more less into a protest and more into perhaps an all-out civil war.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, would you characterize what happened in Libya as an all-out civil war?
No, I don't think there was a civil war really in that same kind of way.
That was more of an insurgency with a little help from their friends.
Yes, with NATO's help.
Is this a kind of 50-50 civil war like the American Civil War was?
I have no idea. I mean, this is just news. This is the first time we've seen defectors from the Syrian military go after the Syrian military. This is a new wrinkle in that.
Yeah.
In that protest.
That's very interesting.
Also, speaking of protests and things like that, Leon Panetta is in Afghanistan. He met with Karzai
Secretary
of Defense. He said there has been progress in Afghanistan. He said they are now going to draw 10,000 troops down by year's end. They still have 94,000 troops there. So we'll see what happens. Yeah. But the remainder are scheduled to be out by 2012.
Good. I don't think anybody should be the last one to die for that mistake either. And frankly, I don't think either one of them are mistakes. I think they were crimes, but that's a whole other thing. Ellen Radner, Talk Radio News. Her new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, welcome back. Strange things going on the trade fronts. India is still going through this, in fact, the Singh government almost fell. Mr. Singh almost was taken down by his wanting to open up the country to multinational retailers. Over 90% of the retail industry in India is owned by small family businesses. And they like it that way. And so what they've said is, okay, Walmart or, you know, Gap or whatever, you want to have a retail store in India, or Gucci, or, you know, the brand ones or the large retail ones, you know, the Walmarts or the Bloomingdale's, whatever they may. You don't have a store in India, you have to have a 51% Indian partner. In other words, you will have no say over how this is run. This is how it works in partnerships. 50-50. You can sort of veto each other, but it's squishy. Partnerships are a really, really difficult way to do business. 49-51, it's a dictatorship with a minority owner. Because whoever has that 51% of the ownership gets to make all the decisions, period, end of discussion, no debate, and the person with the 49% has the right to sell that 49% at some point in the future, and, you know, hopefully if the business grows and they make some money, they'll gain some equity. And if there's ever dividends declared, although the 51% owner gets to decide if and when, if there's ever dividends declared or profit distributions or things like that, they can go. So, you know, American companies are looking at this going, I don't know if I want to be a 49% partner. This is how South Korea and Japan and Taiwan kept American manufacturers out of their markets for years and years and years. China, to some extent, does this in manufacturing and in other areas. There's a whole variety of countries around the world. Germany, to some extent, you know, sometimes they don't do it overtly. Typically, they do it not so much with those kind of rules. Sometimes it's domestic content laws like they have in Brazil or in Venezuela. Sometimes it is just enormous bureaucracies where they say, yeah, sure, well, or what looks like an enormous bureaucracy. You know, for the local businesses, it's no problem. Hey, you're a local business. You live here. You work here. That's cool. You've got a business. But when the out-of-country people come in, boy, can it be a mess. And I can tell you this from personal experience. Back in 1983, my best friend Jerry Schneiderman and I, he lives in New York. I, at that time, lived in New Hampshire. We started a company called Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems, and we were importing into the United States from Japan low radiation picture tubes. We ended up having them manufactured down in Georgia because this was back in the early days of computers, and the picture tubes for those computers had very little lead in the glass at the front of them, and they work by having an electron beam hit the phosphorus at the front, and it produces light, but it also produces X-rays. And now radiation decays according to the reciprocal of the square rule, meaning you double the distance, you get a square, or the inverse of the square, the inverse of the square reduction in radiation. So in other words, if you're 4 feet away from the TV set, the radiation, the X-rays it produces are pretty irrelevant. But if you're a foot and a half away from it, like in the early days of computers when they were basically just using TV tubes, you're getting a significant amount of radiation, or at least a measurable amount of X-rays. So our company, our little company, sold these low-radiation screen shields, and we advertised them on, we bought the back cover of Byte magazine, BYTE. It was, you know, the electronic mag. It was sort of the Wired of that era. This was 83. And I went over to Japan to negotiate with a small company there that manufactured nickel nylon fabric that you could put over a picture tube that would give it anti-glare properties, but you could also ground it so it would block out the radiation. And they also manufactured these kind of picture tubes. And we were, you know, and I got to know the Japanese culture somewhat and learned a little bit of Japanese and spent a fair amount of time there. And we tried to do business in Japan. And I can tell you, it is impossible, or at least it was impossible in 1983-84. And it was impossible because they just, you know, hey, if you're not Japanese, if you're not going to get the support of MIDI, the Ministry of Industry and whatever it is, Transportation Industry, I forget what MIDI stands for, but it's basically how the government sponsors business and pays for R&D and things like that. And you're not, and there's all these regulatory hoops, and, you know, there was no overt, no, we're not going to let you do business in our country. But there were all these, you had to jump through all these barriers. So, anyhow, the news today, China has just said that they're going to start putting up to a 21.5% duty on U.S. cars sold in China. And as I said, this is not just, you know, not to pick on China. In fact, actually, it's to congratulate them. We should be doing the same thing. Let me give you a little, this is from my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's from the introduction. And I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to tell you the story. But the details are all there. And it's pretty straightforward stuff. April 14th, 1789. Now, let's step into the Wayback Machine. 1789, it's 2 years after the Constitution has been written. The Revolutionary War is all over. We're operating under the Articles of Confederation. We've been through three presidents. And things aren't going all that well. And so they install the Constitution in the spring of 1789, and create the modern-day United States of America, and that needs a president. And so that president is elected by acclamation. His name was George Washington, but he didn't know that. And so on April 14, 1789, he's out standing in his field, literally, in Mount Vernon, and an old friend of his, Charles Thompson, who was the Secretary of the Continental Congress, which had met in New York City, has ridden by horseback all the way from New York City to Mount Vernon, and he rides up to Virginia. So he rides up to George Washington, standing out there in his field, and says, General Washington, you have been elected president of the United States, and you're going to be sworn in 2 months. You got to make it to New York and get sworn in. Now, George Washington had to do two things. The first thing he wanted to do, he was 57 years old. His mother was 82, and she was dying. And he said, okay, I need to go say goodbye to my mother because she probably will not survive the year. And she didn't. So he said, would you please get a hold of Henry Knox, K-N-O-X, who was one of his fellow generals in the Revolutionary War. Would you send him over here? I need to talk to him. So Charles Thompson gets Henry Knox to go over there. And Washington says, would you please do me a favor, take my measurements. Washington was a big guy. He's like 6'3", 6'4". He had three horses shot out from underneath him during the Revolutionary War. I mean, amazing stories. He says, will you take my measurements and go to Hartford, Connecticut? There's a store that's owned by a man named Daniel Hinsdale there, and it is the only store in America that makes fine men's clothing. Because I want to be sworn in wearing a suit made in the United States of America. Because up until about 3 years earlier, when we won the Revolutionary War, it was illegal in the United States to manufacture fine clothing in the United States. And as soon as we won the war, on April 28, 1783, in Hartford, Connecticut, Daniel Hinsdale started his own clothing company. And so General Knox rode off to Connecticut. George Washington rode off to his mother's home where he said goodbye, and then he began to make his way to New York City where he was sworn in. The first capital of the United States was right across the street from where Wall Street is right now, oddly enough, right by where the occupiers are. There's some irony there. The original revolution, right? That's where George Washington was sworn in. And he was sworn in wearing a brown suit. I know the official painting, he's wearing a black suit. That was a British-made suit for the painting. But when he was sworn in, he was wearing a brown, wool, American-made suit made by Daniel Hinsdale in Hartford, Connecticut. And he set about trying to build American industry. After the break, I'm going to tell you how he did that and why we need to go back to it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the debate between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson on this and why it's important today and what China and Taiwan and Japan and other countries have learned from this.
From California to North Carolina, everything in between, so it seems, was made in China.
Well, and Vietnam and Mexico, and welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, simulcast as TV, on Dish Network, Direct TV, cable systems. It's pretty amazing. Anyhow, Ha Jun Chang wrote this book called Bad Samaritans, The Myth of Free Trade and the Secret History of Capitalism. That's really worth reading. And let me just share with you a few statistics. This is my quoting him in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, about how trade works. In 1961, President Obama went to Kenya. This wasn't in 61, but you know, last year or the year before, President Obama went to Kenya, and he gave this speech about how when his father came from Kenya, Kenya was just as poor as South Korea, with an average per capita annual income of $82 per person per year. And that, you know, Kenya has come up somewhat, but South Korea has come up a lot. I mean, they're approaching our standard of living. And in fact, in terms of things like broadband, they're way ahead of us. So how did that happen? And President Obama, when he was in Kenya, he seemed to think it happened because of free trade. Because if you read Tom Friedman's, you know, The World is Flat, and these other books written by these internationalists, these globalists, these guys who think, you know, every country should be run basically by transnational corporations, forget about nationalism, forget about national boundaries and borders, just leave it up to the World Trade Organization, they'll take care of things. If you read those books, you would think it was free trade. Well, it wasn't. What happened was, first of all, in 1961, the principal exports of South Korea were fish and human hair for wigs. Average per capita income, $82 a year. In fact, Samsung, the Korean technology giant, started out by exporting fish, fruits, and vegetables. Today, it's the largest conglomerate in the world by revenue, $173 billion. So how'd they do this? Well, in 61, a military dictator took over. His name was Park Chung-hee, General Park Chung-hee. And he created this thing called the Heavy and Chemical Industrialization Program and built from scratch South Korea's first steel mill and modern shipyard. They also built a car production place, and what they did was they put up economic barriers around the country. They said, if you want to import something into South Korea, you have to pay a fortune. If you want to buy something from South Korea, we'll sell it to you cheap as long as it's a manufactured good and not a raw material. We are going to become importers of raw materials and exporters of finished goods. That's the definition of a developed country, of a first world country. Even though at that time, their average per capita income was $82 and their principal export was human hair for wigs. Between 72 and 79, per capita income in South Korea grew 500%. They had protectionist slogans. For example, it was a civic duty to report people who were seen smoking imported cigarettes. There was no penalty for it, but it was like, shame them. Import bans, high tariffs, excise taxes on thousands of products. And it turned South Korea around. Japan did the same thing after World War II. Taiwan did the same thing. China's looking at doing it now. Now, who was the first to do it? Well, the first to do it actually was England in the 1500s. It was called the Tudor Plan. Henry II came up with this plan where we're gonna charge enormous amounts of money for things imported. At that time, England's principal export was wool, raw wool. And the roads were dirt and the houses were thatched, and he was a relatively poor king in a very poor country in the United Kingdom. And so he started putting up these barriers to trade, saying, we're not going to, you know, buy things from France anymore. We're going to make them here. And so in 1793, George Washington, he wanted to be inaugurated in an American suit made in America. There was only one company in America making suits. Nobody in America was making weaponry because it had been illegal. The British had said prior to the Revolutionary War, you can't do that. You've got to buy it from the East India Company. It's got to be made in England. Fine clothing has to be made in England. You know, high-quality China ware. All these things have to be made in England. They were illegal to make here in the United States. So George Washington said, you know, he had Alexander Hamilton, his first Secretary of the Treasury, put together an 11-point plan. It's called Hamilton's Report on Manufacturers. You can still read it. It's reprinted in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. And he said, we are going to protect American manufacturing companies by instituting tariffs, tariffs on imported goods. And from the founding of this country until the Civil War, 100% of every penny spent by the federal government, the salary of the president, every member of Congress, the Supreme Court, everybody in the army, every penny spent by the federal government from the founding of this country in 1789 until the Civil War, every penny came from tariffs. And by keeping those tariffs in place, those taxes on imported goods, we built an industrial nation. From the Civil War to World War I, two-thirds of our federal income was tariffs. From World War I to World War II, a third of our federal income was tariffs. Now it's less than 2%. Now it's actually less than 0.2% of total federal income. Our average tariff is less than 2%. We, over the last 30 years, with Reaganomics, have gone, and free trade, this whole free trade policy, we have gone insane. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest importer in the world of raw materials and exporter of finished goods. We brought in iron ore and we shipped out television sets. Now, 30 years later, we are the largest importer of raw materials and importer of finished goods and exporter of raw materials. Now, we export iron ore and we import television sets. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest creditor in the world. Now we're the largest debtor in the world. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest first world nation in the world. Now we're the largest third world nation in the world. This is the insanity of free trade. How do we turn this around?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The way we do it is we say, hey, look at what the rest of the world is doing. Let's blow out the WTO and let's wake up our politicians. Up next, the good, bad, and the ugly, and your calls.
Thank you.
the good, the bad, and the very, very diverse, volently ugly. That word describes how I was on Fox last night. Here's a link. There's a link to the clip at TomHartmann.com. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, supplement for your brain. The good, Time Magazine. Time named its 2011 Person of the Year to be the protester, citing the Arab Spring, the demonstrations against austerity in Greece, the rise of the Occupy Wall Street movement in the U.S. Time writes, quote, all over the world, the protesters of 2011 share a belief that their country's political systems and economies have grown dysfunctional and corrupt, sham democracies rigged to favor the rich and powerful and prevent significant change. They are fervent small-d Democrats. End quote. Kudos to the magazine for recognizing we are living in a time of great change and revolution against the global banking system and neoliberalism. The bad, Christine O'Donnell. The I'm not a witch Republican Senate candidate from Delaware is trying to soak up the last 15 minutes of her 15 minutes of fame, going on CNN this morning to defend her endorsement of Mitt Romney for president. O'Donnell trumpeted her praise on Mitt, saying he is consistent. And when she was pressed about how many times Romney has changed his mind, O'Donnell said, that's one of the things I like about him, because he's been consistent since he changed his mind. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Just like Newt Gingrich has been faithful ever since he cheated on his first two wives. Something tells me Mitt is not too enthused by his latest endorsement. I give it 2 weeks until Romney has to cut his own commercial, assuring us that he, too, is not a witch. And the very, very ugly Chuck E. Cheese. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, 9 Chuck E. Cheese restaurants in the Bay Area have been fined by the U.S. Department of Labor for violating federal child labor laws. Apparently, the restaurant had minors operating dangerous machinery like trash compactors and dough mixing machines. Chuck E. Cheese has agreed to pay the $28,000 fine from the Department of Labor and comply with laws regarding child labor. Unclear if the restaurant will rethink its motto, where a kid can be a kid. On the bright side, Newt Gingrich, who thinks child labor laws are truly stupid, will likely come out in full support of Chuck E. Cheese, and that's very, very ugly. So anyhow, you heard my rant on free trade. I think it's let me just boil it down really, 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 really simply. Free trade, so-called free trade, first of all, there is no such thing as free trade because countries define the rules of trade. But what we call international free trade, global free trade, is simply a fancy way of saying we're going to let the transnational corporations, the top 100 of whom are larger than all but the top 10 or 15 countries in the world, we're going to let the transnational corporations run the world and tell us how we do our business. WTO, just yesterday, said, sorry, America, you can't have labels that define the country of origin on your meat products, and you can't have labels on your tuna fish cans that say that they're dolphin safe. Because that's going to cause some corporation, someplace in some other country to lose money. Can't do it. Illegal restraint of trade. We have turned our national sovereignty over to the World Trade Organization. It's insane. We need to pull out of the WTO. You know, George W. Bush pulled out of a treaty with Russia simply by saying, I'm just unsigning the treaty. I forget what it was, some nuclear armament thing. And he just said, that's it, I'm pulling out. We need to do that with the WTO and GATT and NAFTA and all these other trade agreements. Just say, that's it. We're going to have a trade policy that benefits the United States. And every one of those other nations should do the same. Mexico should say, we're going to have a trade policy that benefits Mexico. Canada should say, we're going to have a trade policy that benefits Canada. Just like China right now is saying, we're having a trade policy that benefits China. Japan is saying, we're having a trade policy that benefits Japan. Taiwan. Anyway, have you noticed that the countries that are doing well, Germany is another great example, have trade policies that basically benefit them? And forget how rich a country is. You could say, all these poor countries, they need free trade. No, they need to become independent. Because here you have the richest country in the world, the United States, and we're being wiped out by free trade. So, anyhow, that's what's going on. Scott in Skowhegan, Maine. Scott, am I saying it right?
Let me get you off speaker. Hang on.
Sure.
Is that better?
That's better. What's up?
Okay. Hey, I don't know what else I can add to what you just said.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I guess I'd, beyond what you just ranted about was how in the world did we get dragged into this?
We got dragged into this by...
I mean, I can't see Bush being smart enough to come up with something like that. I really think it was written by the multinationals for multinationals.
Oh, of course it was.
I can't see him doing it.
The rise of the modern multinational corporation really started happening in the 1960s and 70s. And the first, you know, Coca-Cola and some of the international weapons manufacturers, that was the rise of the modern multinational corporation, McDonald's going all around the world. And so arguably Richard Nixon was the first guy who really was singing this song when he said, we're going to open up China. And what we all learned later on was that he was there, you know, basically paid for by Pepsi. He was trying to open China to Pepsi so that they would choose Pepsi over Coke when the day came that they started engaging in commerce with the United States.
Yeah.
And so Nixon began singing this song about how we need free trade. And that got picked up by Gerry Ford, who continued to sing that song. Jimmy Carter, I mean, none of them did a lot about it, but they all said, yeah, it's a great idea, Jimmy Carter, a little more. He deregulated things a little more. We still had fairly high tariffs at that time. I mean, the average tariff into the United States was in the 20s, and, you know, 20%, between 20 and 30%. So we still had some industries left in the United States. We still made clothes and jeans and computers and TV sets and washing machines and, you know, fill in the blank. All those empty factories that if you take Amtrak from D.C. up to New York, all you see is nothing but empty factories all the way. All of those were still humming away in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even into the early 80s. And then Reagan came in and he started doing these most favored nation status, which is basically a fancy way of saying, okay, one-on-one with other countries, we're going to do away with tariffs and allow have free trade with them. And that started the process rolling. And then Clinton came along after that, and you'll recall the election of 92, you had Ross Perot going, you know, if you guys do this, you're going to have a giant sucking sound down, you know, all the way down. And
Ross caught it right on the nose.
Ross was totally right, and 19% of America voted for him. I mean, not a single senator. I think everybody thought his vice presidential candidate, Admiral Stockwell, was, you know, a little, you know, who am I, why am I here, right? He was a little nutty. But Ross Perot was right. And in fact, here's what Ross Perot had to say.
And you can move your factory south the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, hire a young 25. That's assuming you've been in business for a long time. You've got a mature workforce. Pay a dollar an hour for your labor. Have no health care. That's the most expensive single element making a car. Have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
And both Bush and Clinton said, no, we think this is going to be a good thing. And Bill Clinton has kind of walked his way back from that a little bit, but basically, you know, we got GATT and NAFTA on his watch, and then George W. Bush put it on steroids. I mean, we lost 50,000 factories during George W. Bush's presidency.
Yeah. Well, I hear them talking now, both sides, about, oh, we're in a recession and whatnot, but they keep adding more free trade agreements. They just did Panama and South Korea.
Yep.
And I think what they've effectively done is they've sold us out to the lowest bidder and in the process given away their tax base.
Yeah. And
on average, every 9 years, this country would go into a recession, 9-10 years.
Yeah.
We always had manufacturing to bail us out. We could depend on that.
We did.
And that's gone.
And you're right. When Reagan
strong enough to pull us out of this, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, well said, Scott. And thank you for calling, and making the point. When Reagan came into office, 34% of our economy was manufacturing. It's now 11%. So, you know, we don't have that to fall back on. That's what we had to fall back on in the Great Depression. We came out of the Great Depression by rebuilding manufacturing. And it's just, you know, we just don't have that anymore. I mean, it's a tragedy. Steve in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom, good to speak to you. Yeah, I had a question. You know, I recall back 25, 30 years ago when they were talking all this free trade talk, and I was kind of ambivalent to it. I wasn't as engaged in politics and policy then. Today, I'm definitely against it. But what I wanted to ask Tom was, to what degree were these people maybe sincere about so-called free trade?
I think the vast majority of the politicians were actually drinking the Kool-Aid. I don't think that Bill Clinton was trying to sell us out. I don't think that Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan were. I think that they thought that this would be a good thing for the United States. In fact, there's a theory of trade that came along with Henry II's Tudor plan, that when you got so developed, when you became the big dog in the world in terms of manufacturing, that you would then lower your trade barriers because it would make it easier for you to basically subsume the rest of the world, you know, take over other markets. And I think that they thought that that's what would happen. And what they didn't expect would happen was that China, Japan, Taiwan, Venezuela, Brazil, Germany, that other countries would say, we're going to have trade policies that benefit us, thank you very much. We're not just going to go along with you and become your vassal state. And so, you know, we were too smart by half. And I think it's time for us to wake up and say, you know, okay, we were too smart by half. It didn't work. It's failed. Thank you, Steve, for the call. It has failed. And not only has it failed, it's destroying the American middle class. We need to bring back manufacturing. We need to be making things in this country. And every country in the world needs to be doing that, making things in their own country. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the U.S. Court of Appeals yesterday struck down a Wisconsin law limiting $10,000 donations. You couldn't donate more than $10,000 to a candidate. Bad.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, we'd really rather they didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Our cheesy news alert brought to you by Andy Borowitz, Borowitz.com, BorowitzReport.com, actually, with tongue-in-cheek, of course. The Fox News Channel made history today by naming Pepper Spray its Person of the Year for 2011. Fox anchor Megyn Kelly noted the historic nature of the nod, indicating that pepper spray was the first food product, essentially, to receive such prestigious recognition. From Tahrir Square to Lower Manhattan to UC Davis to Walmart, Ms. Kelly said brave little pepper spray was there, adding, I'm tearing up a little right now, which I guess is the effect that pepper spray has on people. She added, I truly is a little crowd control, the little crowd control weapon that could. News of the awards stoked speculation that pepper spray might soon be given its own nightly show on Fox. According to one network source, one format being considered would involve a canister of pepper spray, interviewing members of the so-called Occupy movement, and then spraying them in the face. Perfect. As I said, tongue-in-cheek. BorowitzReport.com. Andy Borowitz on that. John in San Luis Obispo. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, not much, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I think we should change the name of free trade agreement to forced trade agreement, because there's nothing really free about it. I own a small business. No one ever asked me about if I think that some job should be sent overseas, or if it could be done cheaper in China or India or Indonesia.
Or if you want to compete with a giant transnational that is got labor at $1 an hour where you have to hire Americans.
Yeah, so how is that free? And so it should be called forced, because we're forced, the USA is forced into this agreement by people who most of us don't even know.
Yeah.
And don't know what their real intention is besides making money.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty clearly it. Now, John, you nailed it on the head. Thank you very much. Well said. Barbara in Detroit. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate the history lesson that you shared, starting with Washington on up to present day.
Thank you.
But what I can't understand is why then are we continuing in trade agreements that are actually doing us more harm than good?
Because the large corporations make a lot of money from this, and they buy our politicians. And until we get money out of politics, until we overturn the Supreme Court ruling of Citizens United and others like it that have made corporations people, until we amend the Constitution and go to movetoamend.org and sign that petition, until we amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people and money is not speech, we are going to continue to have this problem where insane trade policies and other policies as well are pursued because they're profitable to corporations. but they, you know, regardless of their impact on human beings, it's just like the WTO saying you can't label dolphin safe tuna as dolphin safe tuna. You can't label beef by its country of origin. You can't talk about what's in your vegetables or where they were grown. Why? Because it'll hurt the profitability of some corporation that you may not want to buy that product from. That is wrong. Barbara, thank you for the call. Excellent question. Jim in Pine City, Minnesota. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you. I really appreciate your work, and I watch your program regularly, and thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
I wanted to share something that happened to me recently. I'm enjoying my first year of retirement from 33 years of teaching, and I received a postcard from the NEA, the National Education Association, offering me a chance to earn more interest by opening a money market savings account through Bank of America, where I would get 1.07% plus an extra 1% for the first 60 days.
Right.
And it's really hard to find any kind of decent interest in banks anymore,
right,
whether by local credit union or wherever. So I called to sign up for the account. And when it came to depositing money, I asked the lady, I said, well, I'm in rural Minnesota, and I'm quite a distance from any Bank of America office. Can I get some deposits or something to deposit into the account? She says, well, there's a $5 fee for that. And I was quite stunned, but my first response was, are you serious?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, and when she paused, I just happened to just come out of this. I said, you know something, ma'am? This is why the 99% movement is growing. It should get stronger. I completely support it, and I hope you see why it's getting strong.
Yeah, there you go.
And she put me on hold for a bit, and she came back, and she says, I'll tell you what, sir. I will give you a box of checks, complimentary for the first one, but we'll have to charge the fee thereafter.
Right. Yeah, it's here, little boy, let me give you this heroin for free the first time, or these cigarettes for free the first time. That's the business that they're in. So, and it's a shame that the union, you know, got in bed with them. Jim, thanks for the call and for the heads up. From Jim to Jim in Los Angeles. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Pleased to meet you. I had a comment. Back in the 1980s, Harley Davidson was in horrible shape.
Yeah,
and,
nearly out of business.
They wanted to, a group of investors wanted to take the company private. They wanted to buy it from AMF. Ronald Reagan went and pushed through a tariff on Japanese motorcycles to protect Harley Davidson.
Yeah, he was successful, and he did, and that tariff caused Harley Davidson to exist to this day.
Exactly, and protected a lot of union jobs, coincidentally, which brings me to my second point. A lot of this is a very subtle way of reducing the manufacturing base and fighting unions on the part of conglomerates.
Yeah, because from Reagan to today, we've seen our manufacturing base go from 34% to 11%, and that manufacturing base used to be more than 50% unionized. We had 26% of our labor force was unionized when Reagan came into office. Now it's 8% of the federal or of the non-federal union force of the, you know, private sector union force, 11% when you include government employees. And that's why they're going after the post office. You know, the post office is the second largest employer in the United States behind Walmart, and it's the largest unionized employer in the United States. And that's why they put this poison pill legislation through that said that the post office had to fund in 10 years, 75 years worth of retirement health benefits. And it's just absolutely nuts. So anyhow, coming up next, join me for all the news you need to know. Plus, we're going to talk about inequality in the economy, the payroll tax cut, the Keystone XL pipeline, GOP candidates, slugfest, all this stuff coming up tomorrow on the program. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get active, when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.